Welcome to Ring of Fire, I'm Farron Cousins. Coming up on today's show, we're going to give you the latest updates on what is happening with Russia's ongoing assault against Ukraine and how Vladimir Putin's desperation to not lose is making him a much more dangerous individual. We also have Panama Bartholomew from the Building Decarbonization Coalition, and he's going to tell us how state by state, his group is working to reduce emissions and tackle climate change since we can't get any real action from the federal government. And I'm taking your questions from the Ring of Fire YouTube channel. So if you want to get in on that in the future, go subscribe at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. And of course, you can become a member of the ROF podcast. Get access to all of our content, including our archives. Go and sign up at ROFpodcast.com. So talks between Ukraine and Russia appear, at least for the moment, to have broken down. Late last week, the two sides were getting together, trying to come up with a plan to end the conflict. And of course, at the time, they agreed to a ceasefire, but apparently only verbally, because Russia continued their assault, which included attacks on a hospital this week, on a children's hospital. Russia bombed a Ukrainian children's hospital this week. Now, of the talks, what Russia's demanding is exactly the same thing they demanded at the start of this conflict, which, of course, is you have to recognize that we have annexed Crimea. That's ours. You can't have it back. You also have to give up the areas in your country with a lot of these, you know, Russian nationalists, the people who want to be a part of Russia. You have to give those to us. And, of course, you have to add to your constitution that you are not now, will, nor you ever join NATO. That's what they wanted before the invasion. That's what they still want now. They are not backing down. But Ukrainian officials say that they may, you know, have some inroads they can make somewhere. But we don't know right now, of course, what that is going to look like or if it's ever going to come to fruition. So what's happening at the moment, in addition to the escalating attacks by Russia, is that Vladimir Putin is starting to feel desperate. And that makes him far more dangerous than he was when this thing began. See, Putin and his, you know, officials, generals, whatever they are, thought they could go into Ukraine, annex essentially these two portions of Ukraine before the West could ever mobilize, before they could do anything, before sanctions, before anything else. Russia thought very quick, run in, get out, we're done, we've got what we want here. That obviously did not happen. You know, there has been tremendous pushback from Ukraine. They have done a phenomenal job, you know, holding off these Russians. And now Vladimir Putin doesn't know what to do. I mean, they are militarily superior to Ukraine. There's no doubt about that. And yet they're being held off by a population, not just the Ukrainian military, but by a population that wants to protect their country. It truly is admirable what we're seeing here. And so Putin doesn't know what to do now. And that is why we see these escalating attacks. That's why we saw this attack, the bombing of a children's hospital. They're going after more and more civilian areas because they don't know what else to do. And again, that makes them far more dangerous. We obviously had about 2 weeks ago, it was, they said they were putting their nuclear deterrent forces on high alert. Then they said, oh no, that was wrong. We were basing our information of that on a faulty British piece of reporting. So, you know, we don't really have a good clear picture of what is going on, of what is real and what is not in terms of Russia. We can see the damage and the devastation they're causing in Ukraine. There's no doubt about that. But what happens as Putin continues to get more and more desperate? Because he has put himself in this position. And as we all know, Putin is the guy that likes to go out there shirtless, prove to everybody he's a big, tough, macho guy. You can't beat him. I'm the best. I'm the biggest. I'm the strongest. Exactly what Donald Trump wants to be. But he can't quite pull it off the way Putin has. So he's not just going to turn tail and run. He has to somehow try to save face. And again, that's what's so scary. He knows he can't go slinking back to the public and say, yeah, oh boy, was that a miscalculation? Oops, right? No, he's not going to do that. So he is going to make it to where Ukraine has no choice but to surrender to them. And again, I believe that's why he's now attacking more and more civilian populations. On the other side, Russia actually does want them out. You know, the Russian citizens are getting hammered by the sanctions that are in place, not just from the United States, but from most of the rest of the world. They don't want any part of that. They don't want any part of the invasion even without the sanctions. They don't support this. Over 6,000 protesters have already been arrested in Russia. And God only knows what they're going to do to them. But they don't want a part of this, and they're the ones who are paying the biggest price in that country right now. Oh, sure, we've got billionaire oligarchs from Russia. We're seizing their yachts, which is wonderful. We're freezing their assets, which is great. But the majority of those sanctions are impacting the little people. And that's not fair. They didn't sign up for this. They don't deserve that. Their money is effectively worthless at this point. Those sanctions have crippled them so hard, which, by the way, is another reason why Putin cannot walk away from this empty-handed. And he's not going to. He sees what's happening to his country. He knows people are pissed at him. So if he goes back with nothing, that's the end, right? That's the end for him. So again, we will see more desperation. We will see more of these attacks. And I fear that it's going to escalate to the point where either NATO gets fully involved, sending troops, Europe may do that, and the United States may follow suit. Right now, we as a country, the United States, have done a good job of staying out of it. And I hope we continue to do that. The problem is, you have Ukrainian President Zelensky that is pushing for NATO, for Europe, for the United States to declare a no-fly zone over Ukraine. And if that happens, that is, you know, not officially, but unofficially, a declaration of war. It becomes a hot war at that point. Because what a no-fly zone does, for those who may not, you know, be familiar with this, says if any Russian plane flies over this no-fly zone airspace, we shoot you down. We don't try to talk to you. We don't negotiate. We see you. We shoot you. You're gone. And of course, if the United States or if Europe actively attacks a Russian plane, Russia is going to retaliate. We're talking about nuclear powers here, folks. The United States, Russia, several other European countries. This is dangerous. This is why people do fret about this possibly starting World War III. Nobody wants to be in that position. Nobody wants to see that happen. You know, maybe Putin does. I don't know. Let's hope he doesn't. But if he gets desperate enough, I firmly believe he would. I don't think he would hesitate. I think that is absolutely what he would go after if he felt that was his only option to save face within his own country. So that terrifies me. The United States, again, great job of not going for the no-fly zone thing. We have to hold fast to that. Banning Russian oil imports? Okay, cool. I'm good with that. I have no problem with that. I wish we would also do the same for, you know, Saudi Arabia and all of the atrocities committed at the hands of that government all over the Middle East. Yet we still act like they're our friends. And they won't even do anything to help lower oil prices for us as we go groveling to them, saying, please help us, we're getting killed at the pump. And they say, yeah, we don't care. Thanks for all the weapons you've sent us. We're using those to kill civilians over in Yemen right now. It's working out great for them. For Saudi Arabia, that is. Not so much for literally anybody else on the globe. United States got to do a better job picking our friends and our allies in the future, I believe. Saudi Arabia is not one of them. They're not on our side in this conflict. They don't have our back in our time of need when oil prices, gas prices are squeezing the average American citizen. They don't care. All they care about is when are you going to send us the next shipment of weapons so that we can go kill more people. That's what it is. So that's the hell, I guess we could call it, that is foreign affairs right now. And it is scary. It's terrifying. But it's more terrifying for the people of Ukraine. It's terrifying for the people in Russia. None of them signed up for this. None of them wanted this. This is Putin's war of aggression. Just like Crimea in 2014. I don't care what they tell you. If you go back and you actually look at the history of that, that was Russian aggression, and so is this. Anyone telling you otherwise, well, let's just say I imagine their paycheck depends on them telling you otherwise. New York Governor Kathy Hochul is poised to actually help decarbonize buildings in the state of New York. Now, that may seem a little bit confusing to some folks, but luckily, I have a guest with me right now who actually runs an organization, the executive director of the Building Decarbonization Coalition. I'm joined now by Panama Bartholomew. I hope I pronounced that correctly. So, Panama, thank you so much for being here today. This is such an extraordinary issue that people really don't think about, but the numbers, what your organization is doing, absolutely sorely needed here. So let's start by talking about the Building Decarbonization Coalition. What exactly is that?
First off, Aaron, thanks for having me on the pod. Long time listener, first time caller. So it's good to be here. So building decarbonization, I think nobody thinks about that. Usually the types of work that we do that people think about is how they're comfortable in their home, how they're cooking their food, how their showers are great, and how their clothes get dry. And so what we're concerned about is that behind many of the households' ways that they do that is a significant fossil fuel, and it's significant from a perspective of local air quality problems, and it's significant from a perspective of trying to fight climate change. And so this term decarbonization, it's a pretty wonky term that really speaks to how do we still have the same or better quality of life, but do it while having a significantly reduced impact on the environment. And so our organization really helps the industry, it helps government agencies, and it helps households find ways to do that.
And you've got some wonderful ads that are now running, really highlighting this issue. And, you know, in just a moment, we're going to get deeper into that New York issue. But again, I do want to touch on the fact that what people don't seem to think about very often as you're talking about, the comfort in our home. When you have homes that are actually powered directly by fossil fuels, or buildings, of course, powered directly by fossil fuels, we're talking about the burning of these fuels, the consumption of them, the conversion of them into energy on site, which means that these emissions that come from this aren't from some far off factory in the distance. It's coming from your property, and this does create a lot of residential and even commercial emissions, right there where you live, where you work, and people don't seem to think about it, right? Oh, though the power plant is way, way over there. I'm not in the harm's way of all these fumes. Well, you're not exactly as safe as you would think here.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a big issue in large metropolitan areas as well, because when you burn natural gas or methane makes up about 90% of all the natural gas that we use. When you burn that, it produces basically three things. It produces nitrogen oxides, which is the major precursor of smog, carbon monoxide, which is why you have carbon monoxide monitors in your home, and then formaldehyde as well. And you want to get those out of your living space or out of your workspace as quickly as possible. And so that's why every home that burns gas in it for heat, it has vents that gets it up into the atmosphere. And unfortunately, we've never really thought through what that meant for large metropolitan areas. And so we've done a ton of work about reducing emissions from power plants and from cars over the last four decades. And we've done almost no work about reducing pollution from buildings. And so I'm based out here in California myself, and we have five of the worst air basins for air quality in the country. And out here, because we've done so much work on power plants and cars and not on buildings, the burning of gas in buildings is producing 5 times more smog than our entire fleet of power plants and twice as much as cars in car crazy California. And so it's good that you bring this up because it's a really significant issue in our major metropolitan areas.
And it's certainly timely too, right? I mean, the issue of energy consumption is clearly on everybody's minds right now, mostly obviously with gasoline prices going, you know, haywire and everybody saying, oh my God, what do we do here? Well, the answers to a lot of these problems, not just with the automobiles, but with the building, with the fossil fuel power plants, with the coal burning, with the, you know, fracked gas, with all of this, the solutions have been in front of us for a very long time. We as a country are not adopting them to the level that we should be. And that is the ultimate goal with all of this, is we can, with the innovation, with revamping the power grid, we can make this into where this isn't that much of an issue, or hopefully in the future, not an issue at all for us. But we have to have that initiative. We have to have that drive as a full country to actually get us there. And, you know, we still do not have that yet.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, the last month has really brought into focus some of the dangers of dependency on gas or methane. And the reality is that this is an international market that we have very little control over. And when events take place, like what's happening in Europe right now, that start to cause constrictions of gas supply, that has real world impacts here in the United States as far as the cost of gas. And over the next few months, we're going to have a real reckoning as our gas supplies on the domestic side are going to start to be used to be shipped overseas in order to be helping with international conflicts rather than powering our homes or our power plants. And so it's a really excellent time right now to get a handle on our energy independence and think through, okay, how do we start to reduce dependency on a fossil fuel that not only do we not have good control over, but is now one of the leading drivers of climate change that we're seeing in the world as well. And you're absolutely right. The good news is this isn't like some sort of moonshot technology. These are technologies that are being installed by the millions all over the United States. Heat pumps for your heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. Heat pump water heaters. Looks just like a tank water heater with an R2-D2 on top. Induction stoves that blow the door off your best gas stove. And these are technologies that are available if you go into any Home Depot or Lowe's, and you can find these technologies in there. So the good news is that they're available. And now you hit the nail on the head, which is how do we get these deployed at the scale and the speed that we need in order to meet our clean air and our climate goals?
And right now, you know, let's pivot, perfect time to pivot over to New York, right? You got Kathy Hochul there. And what she is now on board with is the decarbonization of these buildings. And of course, when people think of, you know, the big skyscrapers all over New York, the big giant apartment buildings, this is really a perfect place for a project like this to take hold. So tell us a little bit about what is going on in New York.
Governor Hochul is put herself out at the front of the pack on leadership on this issue right now. And I have to compliment her. She and her State of the State address back in January 5th really provided the most comprehensive vision for how to address the building sector in our climate change policies. And right now, her administration is pulling through a huge plan for how to address every aspect of buildings. And I think the good news is, Farron, is that she's doing it with equity front of mind and the recognition that in this transition, we can't be leaving any communities behind, particularly those communities that have already been hit the hardest by fossil fuel extraction and then the impacts of fossil fuel, like poor air quality. And so what she's laid out is a truly comprehensive approach that I'll just go over briefly. One, she said, we need to take a fundamentally different approach to how we plan for energy infrastructure. Right now, it's just pretty much rubber stamps of if a gas company comes in and they want to expand a gas line, it's like, all right, there's not a review about how that affects our air quality locally, how that affects climate change. It's like, all right, let's get that pipeline built and hook all those new homes back up to it without real regard to how this is going to play into our other goals that we're trying to reach. we still have significant subsidies for gas. We subsidize the hooking up of gas to every home in New York. We subsidize really efficient gas appliances. And so in her proposal, she's saying we need to stop subsidizing, digging the hole deeper that we're finding ourselves into, and instead shift those subsidies over to clean electrification. And then she's calling for the building of 2 million climate-ready homes and buildings by 2030. And so really trying to make New York the center of innovation for this movement so that she can be bringing in investment and industries into New York to be able to provide this. So she's providing that wonderful comprehensive view, but then also very targeted measures about how we go about doing this. And then the last thing is she's saying we need to decide when we're going to stop digging the hole any deeper. And we know that the expansion of the gas network isn't aligned with our climate laws. And so she is proposing that by 2027, we no longer build any new buildings with gas in New York. And that will start to take away this approach where we put 60-year infrastructure in the ground when the state's trying to reach carbon neutrality over the next 25 years. And the stranded assets are going to come from that and all the ratepayers having to pay that off. And so as much as it's a climate law, Farron, it's also it's economically prudent thing to do to protect ratepayers into the future.
You know, this reminds me of a statistic that I used to use very frequently. I was a contributor for Desmog blog, so I was constantly writing about climate issues, environmental, you know, climate change things. For every, and this was, you know, God, 4 or 5 years ago, back when I ended that actually, but the statistic back then was for every $1 that you invest in renewable energy or in regulation, you know, basically the things that you're talking about here, for every $1 you invest, you get $7 back in new economic activity. And that to me is one of the best ways to help sell this, because we do have a lot of people that are scared. You know, they're scared of regulation because they've been trained to be scared of that word. They're scared of changes. You know, oh God, things are going to be different. My car can't go as fast because it's an electric vehicle. Or, oh, what's going to happen to energy prices? What's going to happen to these energy jobs? None of that goes away. It just gets reallocated and expanded. You know, when Hillary Clinton was running for president, I think one of the greatest proposals she had was she wanted to invest $30 billion into the United States to retrain, essentially, fossil fuel workers to go work in the renewable energy field. It was barely a blip on anybody's radar, by the way, when she announced this plan, but absolutely would have been one of the most ambitious plans to date, possibly even more so than the Green New Deal, to actually get America on that path that we need to be on. And that is what it's going to take. And again, if we look at just the numbers on it, if we put in $30 billion, we're looking at modestly over $200 billion in new economic activity because of an investment like that. This is a long-term thing we have to deal with. We cannot put it off, but it's also the most economically sound thing that our country could do. But too many voices out there with power refuse to let us make those changes.
Yeah. And that Hillary Clinton proposal, that was back when $30 billion was a really big deal.
Yeah.
We weren't throwing around, you know, hundreds of trillions of dollars of conversations around all the policies that we're working on now. So I absolutely agree. And I think that's one of the things that Governor Hochul's got to be really applauded for, is her concern for the current workforce. I mean, we have basically led thousands of people into really good paying family sustaining jobs on our gas infrastructure. And we need to make sure that our climate policies aren't only fast and meet the moment, but they also are able to protect workers. And so what I've really been encouraged by is her administration, and she's taken a very strategic approach to this, where in the short term, she's proposed, okay, let's renovate over 2,000 schools in New York and electrify them. And let's have just a ton of really great jobs as part of this transition in the immediate term. You can imagine how long 2,000 schools is going to take to fully retrofit. And then at the same time, she says, while we're doing that, I'm going to direct the Public Service Commission, the commission that regulates all the utilities in the gas industry, we're going to do a long-range planning for the gas system and how to eventually start to wind it down as we wind up electrification in these buildings. And a significant part of that is the workforce part. And so looking at natural attrition and retirement rates and training new people to come in, training more and more people to be coming into the electric side and ramping that up as the gas workers are naturally attritioning, and to be able to elegantly bring folks into the future of energy as we're taking people out of the past of energy. So I've really been really pleased with Governor Hochul's approach on that.
And to me, it seems like this is how we're going to have to do things like this. You know, it would be wonderful, obviously, to have a big national federal movement, federally funded plan to do this. But the gridlock you get there. Yeah. I mean, you can't penetrate that right now. Things are probably more partisan than at least any point in my life, maybe not through history, but definitely in my short time on this planet, probably looks worse than it has been. But a state by state plan. Now, that could work. That could easily be implemented. And I think New York is a phenomenal example of that. You know, California, same thing. We can do this in these big states. They can lead by example, show the neighboring states like, look, we did this. Wasn't easy. We had to spend money. But now look at what has happened. And I think just the look at what we did type mentality for these neighboring states, that could easily get some of these other places on board. And it does need to start with the big areas. Obviously, New York, New York City, everybody thinks of Manhattan. Yes, that is a great place to do it. California, same thing. You know, Midwest states don't have as much of that, you know, big city feel. So they'll come later and we will get them, but we've got to get the big emissions out of there first. And state by state is probably the only way we're going to be successful with that. And that's why I love what you do, because that's really what this is. We got to go where we can actually get something done now. And it's brilliant.
Well, thank you. And we agree completely with that, is that you usually never see really big comprehensive things come out of Washington, D.C. unless there's a crisis. And usually you don't have careful planning for that. And so we agree that it's going to take a coalition of states coming together and harmonizing their approaches on this issue to be able to send really clear market signals to industry about where they're going, to be able to give industry enough assurance that they can be making investments into changing out manufacturing lines and supply chains and the training of workers. And it's only through that kind of bottom-up action that Washington, D.C. will actually be forced to act on something like this. If you have about 15 states representing 60% of gas demand all harmonizing in one direction and the rest of the states not, you need some sort of federal agency to step in at that point and provide a level playing field. And so it's going to be the New Yorks and Californians, who by themselves are about a fifth of all gas demand in the United States. But it's also going to be the Massachusetts, it's going to be the New Jerseys, it's going to be the Minnesotas, the Illinois, and the Colorados, Washington, Oregon, and I can go on. The good news is that there's a lot of states right now working on this, and it's going to be all of our work now to try to make that look coordinated, and there's some consistency across it so that the industry has the time and the direction to be able to respond, because we don't have a lot of time on this. You know, we got to get going. These water heaters have about a 12-year life cycle. Furnaces have a 15 to 20 year life cycle. And so if we're trying to get rid of most of our emissions over the next 20 years, we can't be installing another two cycles of furnaces. We really have to be hitting these furnaces right now. And so we need some clear messages going out to industry about where these states are going.
Well, and you know, another kind of side part of that I'm thinking of here is, obviously, when you decrease demand for these utilities, you know, a decreased demand for gas, it is going to negatively impact that industry. Obviously, a huge boom for renewables and all these other sources here. So that's another thing that the, you know, national politicians are going to have to look at. How long are you going to continue propping up and subsidizing these industries that there's just not that big of a demand for anymore? Do you continue, you know, riding the Enron stock all the way down? Or do you eventually say, listen, this is not worth it for us. instead of spending the $14 billion a year subsidizing these industries at the federal level, God knows how many more billions combined at the state level, maybe it's time we put that money to better use. And I think watching as the demand falls and these industries go begging for more money, which is what they always do, we could see the federal government and maybe even other state governments that are initially hesitant start to say, even we can't justify this anymore. You're going down because the world has changed and you didn't change with it. These companies could have, struck gold by hopping on and being, Exxon could be the leader in creation of solar panels. Chevron could be providing windmills. They easily could have done it. They made the choice and they're going to have to live with that as the world moves forward and they try to keep us in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the challenge with this space, with buildings, is that unlike oil and electric vehicles or unlike power generation and coal, is you have gas that has a very strong foothold in communities. And we've, as you've said, we've invested billions and billions of dollars over the years expanding the gas network out into all of our communities. And so that's a ton of financing that we as ratepayers are now paying off. And as we shut it down, we're going to be accelerating those payments. And so it's just exactly what you said. It's going to take some leadership to really stop this spiral and make sure that we can elegantly transition out of this fuel. And the opportunity is there. And I think what you have is, unfortunately, you have a bunch of people in leadership in fossil fuel industries that came up within a reality of just selling fossil fuels, selling hydrocarbons. And the transition seems to be going too fast for much of the leadership that they can bring into those organizations. And so you're seeing startups and smaller companies really just fly by them, providing what's going to be the future of energy. And it's at some point, it's going to be a real question for them. Are you going to be the dinosaurs selling dinosaur juice, or are you going to be getting on the right side of this and being a stable and profitable company out into the future?
Well, and organizations like yours are helping lead the charge there. So Panama Bartholomew, excuse me.
You got it.
I've enjoyed this conversation today. It is an absolutely important issue. People have to be aware of this, have to get involved, have to, demand the change that we need. And your group is doing a great job helping to lead that movement. So thank you very much for talking with us. And of course, thank you for everything that your organization is doing.
Awesome. Farron, thank you very much. Governor Hochul, thanks for your leadership. And thank you to all the listeners today. Appreciate you having me on.
That's it for this week's free portion of Ring of Fire. Coming up for the member show, we've got questions from our Ring of Fire YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. And if you want access to that, and of course the entirety of the Ring of Fire archives, go sign up and become a member at rofpodcast.com.